Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Rising sea levels, extreme weather patterns, extinctions of species. Our planet needs protecting. I'm Adam Vaughan, the environment editor for The Times, and this is Planet Hope from The Times, in partnership with Rolex and its Perpetual Planet Initiative. In this podcast, we hear from leading experts from around the world who are committed to finding solutions. These explorers, scientists, entrepreneurs, and citizens are committed to a common goal: to protect our home, Earth. Listen now wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello and welcome to the Game Podcast from The Times. I'm Natalie Sawyer.
And I'm Gabriel Marcotti, and we thank you for joining us on this fine Monday morning, heralding yet another international break. In the studio with us, that's right, it's the only living gear brand in captivity. It's James. Although I've discovered there are multiple gear brands out there because he has at least one sibling. And down the line from Rippenden, the kitchen, just to confirm, Ollie.
No, I'm in the lounge today.
Oh, you're in the lounge. Gotcha.
In the lounge.
Not the snug, the lounge. Got it. It's Ollie Kay. Later on, we'll be talking about the Mourinho story that dominated the weekend and the form team in the country right now. Yes, Arsenal.
Let's get on to our first topic. It was billed as possibly the game of the season, but the two title favourites in the Premier League cancelled each other out as it finished goalless between Liverpool and Manchester City. But the game wasn't without extraordinary late drama. A Leroy Sané brought down by Virgil van Dijk with 5 minutes to go, a penalty given by Martin Atkinson, but that was blasted over the bar by Riyad Mahrez. Ollie, first of all, you were at Anfield. What did you make of the situation with regards to who actually was going to take that penalty? Because it looked as though Gabriel Jesus wanted the ball, but he didn't get it. It was Mahrez in the end, and Pep Guardiola actually sort of afterwards inferred it was his decision.
Yeah, I was slightly surprised. I did, but when I saw Mahrez stepping up, I did think, I'm sure I've seen Mahrez miss a penalty before. I hadn't got it in my mind that he'd missed nearly all of the penalties he's taken in England, but I was looking around and thinking, oh, I can't really see who's going to take this. It's not as obvious as when Aguero's on the pitch, etc. So, or, you know, De Bruyne, you would have thought, would have been a candidate had he been there. But it's Mahrez, there was a question mark over him as he stood over the ball. I think it would have, I mean, other penalties, other City players' penalty records are printed in the Times of there. I don't think they make for terribly impressive reading either. Silva, 0 out of 1. Jesus, 1 out of 3. And Mahrez, what is it now? 3 out of 8. So it was clear that they didn't have a established penalty taker on the pitch. Most people expect a penalty to go in, and as it happens, it went nowhere near. So it was a real let-off for Liverpool, certainly. And a huge disappointment for City, because I thought the final 20 minutes, they looked like they were perhaps going to produce something and win the game. And to have had an opportunity like that and wasted it is a big disappointment to them.
Why are we making a big deal out of this? I don't get this whole sort of debate. Like, and then Guardiola says, oh, he took them in training and he looked good. And the numbers are here, right? Mm. Guardiola watches these people in training and presumably looks at them and says, I've got a hierarchy here in my mind. It's Aguero, it's Gundogan, De Bruyne, but Gundogan, De Bruyne weren't there, now there was Aguero. Maybe he even knows these numbers, right? I'm sure they have a whole stats department.
Well, he said he didn't know about Mahrez's record.
Okay, well, this is not advanced analytics, right? I mean, and he happens to have the best record out of the three of them. And by the way, if David Silva hasn't taken one in 6 years, it's probably also because he doesn't quite fancy taking them. Maybe he doesn't feel right. So what is the big deal with Mahrez taking the penalty? I mean, I don't understand this. Well, why does this become part of the narrative?
I guess because nothing else happened.
I know, honestly, that's it. And, you know, Ollie, I was watching this, and we've criticized City in the past for being too buccaneering, for sometimes maybe not knowing how to slow things down and kill games. I mean, that's kind of what they did here, right? I mean, especially in the first half, it looked to me like the Silva brothers were basically standing next to Fernandinho, who himself was standing, you know, just a few yards ahead of the two central defenders, right? They created density in the middle of the park. They didn't do too much with the ball, and they didn't concede. This is good if you're Pep, right? They're becoming a little bit more multidimensional.
Yeah, I think it was a different kind of Liverpool performance. It was a different kind of City performance. Both a bit more cautious, less willing to, you know, risk anything in the pursuit of 3 points. I mean, people were saying, "Oh, it's two teams parking the bus." It's not parking the bus. Parking the bus is, if it's anything, it's camping deep in your own penalty area and hanging on with 10 men behind the ball. Neither team was doing that, but it was a disappointing spectacle. It was a disappointing spectacle, really, in terms of the kind of entertainment that neutrals would have been hoping for and expecting. But it was good from both teams' point of view in terms of playing a different way, showing they can play in a different way. I think both have been accused of being too inflexible in the past, and I think this probably showed. I think if anything, if you were going to criticise anything, you'd say it would have been a lack of ambition yesterday. I thought City looked vulnerable in the first half hour, and Liverpool didn't really look to press that home. And I think Liverpool looked very vulnerable in the last half hour, and I thought City had enough of the ball in dangerous areas to have taken advantage, and they didn't quite do that in a way that I think they would have done at their best. So I thought it looked like two teams fairly tired after a demanding schedule over the last few weeks, and looking at this situation and thinking, well, okay, it would be great to win this game, but we're not too unhappy with a draw.
It is the first time that the trio of Salah, Firmino and Mane have gone 4 games without any of them scoring. Paul Joyce points that out in the Times today. James, is that a worry for Liverpool?
First of all, I think you have to say Salah, Firmino and Mane, I think, all to a certain extent outperformed last season what they've previously been able to do. I mean, Salah, obviously, by a huge margin. And I think, you know, especially in Europe, you know, where I think Mane and Firmino scored about 10 goals in 15 games. I mean, they've never scored at that kind of rate throughout their careers. I think they've both had one previous season in their careers where they've scored 20 goals. So I think overall, I think you expect some sort of, you know, regression. And I think also City were not at their most ambitious, particularly in terms of the full-back play of Kyle Walker and Benjamin Mondi, who I thought were both very disciplined, didn't really give Liverpool that space in behind to attack. So have they worked them out? Maybe in a sense, but I think, you know, when teams actually want to, you know, have a bit more of an ambition to get forward and score goals, you will still see more space in behind, and that makes it tricky against Salah, Firmino and Mane. I think, you know, there's obviously a lot of talk about Salah, but his underlying numbers in terms of, you know, the shots he's getting off, the expected goals, I think all quite good. So I think there are reasons to be positive. Having said that, I think just to look at them, to actually watch the front three, they don't look quite right at the moment. And I think particularly that's noticeable in terms of the pressing, which obviously is such a trademark. They're not pressing with the same sort of alacrity as they were last season, from what I've seen. And I think that's important because a lot of the chances that front three created last season came from winning the ball back high up the pitch, which is a real trademark of Klopp's, and really allowed them to kind of counteract the loss of Philippe Coutinho and the fact that they don't really have a sort of playmaking midfielder, whether that's energy because all three of them went to the World Cup, I don't know. But now that they're not doing that so much, you're seeing teams who have really high class, you know, ball playing defenders like Man City able to beat the press and play through it a little bit more. And that's, I think, where, you know, you're slightly missing maybe a playmaker like Coutinho.
Ollie, what's your take on this? Because obviously, in terms of results, it's not been a great run the last 4 games, and you know, you can chalk up the Chelsea game, the League Cup one, to the fact that it's the League Cup, and then the other one they had chances that maybe they didn't convert against Chelsea, and against Napoli the explanation I heard was just like, well, you know, it was just their worst performance, it was a one-off, let's move on, and Napoli nothing special. But you put these things together and they do kind of add up. And even looking, you know, the Champions League is a ways off, and they absolutely mullered Paris Saint-Germain. Paris Saint-Germain have been really, really, really good the last couple of games, and they're actually playing like a team. Is there any reason to worry and to be a little bit concerned that the wheels might come off, and that do you think Klopp is maybe thinking slightly differently? Maybe if Keita's fully fit, we might see him from the start, since he does have a little bit of that creativity. Maybe Shaqiri, if the front three are running out of steam.
Well, first of all, I agree with James's diagnosis of the front three problems. I think a lot of it looks like tiredness. A lot of it looks like there has been a conscious decision not to press in the same way, just because of that tiredness. I think Klopp is clearly feeling that he's got to manage them through the first period of the season and get them back up to speed again. I do think these last few games have perhaps shown some of the limitations of this Liverpool team when Salah and Firmino in particular aren't on top of their game. I think they are very reliant on those two, and I think he needs to find a way to get them back to really top form. And I think maybe a gentler run of fixtures after the international break, and just looking at it, Huddersfield, Red Star Belgrade, Cardiff, Arsenal, Red Star, Fulham, Watford. It's certainly a gentler run of fixtures, and maybe then we'll see more of Keita. Maybe then we'll see Salah given the odd rest and Shaqiri brought in and maybe helping Salah get back to form, Firmino back to form, etc. But I do think the overall picture is an encouraging one for Liverpool, but I think the past few performances have brought a bit of a reality check.
This season, with your subscription to The Times and The Sunday Times, you can watch every highlight and every goal from every game in the Premier League. Subscribe now. It's just £1 a month for a three-month trial. On Saturday evening, Manchester United came back from 2-0 down to beat Newcastle 3-2 in a thriller at Old Trafford. But the game was set against the backdrop of Jose Mourinho's apparently imminent departure, a report claiming that Mourinho would be sacked this weekend, no matter what the result against Newcastle. Ollie, how did this story come about?
Well, it was a story in the Daily Mirror on Saturday morning by David McDonald, who was their Manchester football correspondent, has been for, I think, probably about 17 years. So he's not some wet behind the ears reporter, not somebody who, as people might imagine, would make a story up for clicks or hits or whatever. He's a very good reporter. I remember he was the reporter who got the fact that they wrote a story about them holding talks with Louis van Gaal back in 2014 behind Moyes' back when Moyes was still in charge. Got the story about Rooney signing a new contract when everybody was writing, including myself, that he was on the way out back in 2010 or thereabouts.
He's also from Essex, right?
He's from Essex. Well, yeah.
As is Ed Woodward.
Well, I was actually going to point that out, but I think that might be putting two and two together. I don't imagine the story came from Ed Woodward directly, but what I'm saying is that I know people like to think that newspaper journalists just make up stories. Nobody makes up stories, to my knowledge at least. If anybody gets anything wrong, they've done so in good faith on very good information. But his story was that Mourinho was going to be sacked regardless. Now, you don't write that unless you're fairly certain of it, unless you had it on good authority. And so I've no doubt that was the case. Whether that has changed, or let's put it this way, if that was the case on Saturday morning, and I raised an eyebrow when I read it, not because, but just because it was so kind of balls out, if I'm able to use that phrase, it was so unambiguous and not leaving any sort of wriggle room. And I thought, if you looked at Mourinho's interview before the game, I thought it looked like he felt that it was his last game. His body language and the things he said seemed to suggest that he believed it. And you look at his body language throughout the game, I think he was clearly so emotional in the second half and emotional at the final whistle, and maybe he did think it was his final game. I don't know. And who knows, it might yet be. But at the moment, he's in charge. Other people are briefing that he will remain in charge. I would say that the way Saturday developed in terms of going 2-0 down, then all the animosity being expressed by the fans towards the board, not towards Mourinho, but towards the board, and not before time, I would say. And then Mourinho making some changes, and the team finally showing some fight and fighting for him, fighting for each other, getting the result, spectacular fight back. Maybe that is the kind of thing that if people in the United hierarchy had decided, well, look, this has got to change, maybe this is the kind of performance, the one kind of performance and result that would make them just say, well, hang on, let's put our foot on the ball on this one and just give ourselves some time. And I have no doubt it was written in good faith, reported in good faith on the basis of good information. At the moment, as things stand, I don't think he's going to get sacked this week, but it doesn't mean that the story was an act of, you know, a piece of fiction or anything like that.
Can you clear this up? Because you mentioned the board there, and it's part of our sort of footballing vernacular that when people talk about, you know, decisions that are made by a club and it's not the manager, so it's always like the board this, the board that. And I think some people imagine that it's some sort of Senate with people sitting there and taking positions. It's not. When it comes to footballing sphere at Manchester United, the board, for decisions which don't have to do with commercial things and signing partnerships in Vietnam and whatnot, the board is basically Ed Woodward. I know the Glazers are there too, but as far as I know, they don't weigh in on transfer decisions and stuff like that. So, I mean, is that accurate? And is it really a Mourinho-Woodward dichotomy if it's Mourinho against the board, as some people are trying to portray?
Well, the board is very Glazer heavy, if I can put it that way. Ed Woodward is you know, I think one of two board members that's based in England. The rest are in Florida.
It's like Avram Glazer decides, oh yeah, I really like the look of Diogo Dalot. Let's go and sign him, right?
No, absolutely not. But it's not even as if Ed Woodward decides that. I don't know how many footballers Ed Woodward could name off the top of his head, but it didn't seem very many when he took over that job.
All this anger, all those people with having a go at the board. I mean, Gary Neville had this as well. If they're not talking solely about Ed Woodward, who are they talking about?
Well, it'll be the Glazers and
but the Glazers don't. You just
they're underlings.
The Glazers don't get involved in footballing decisions, do they?
Well, that is their decision. The way they run the club is to leave the club in the hands of an investment banker who has shown himself not to be a terribly good football brain, and they're happy with that. They're happy because they believe that their club should be run as a brand and prioritise the brand over the football, and that has been shown over the last 5 years, and that is what people should criticise. It's not about the amount of money a club spends. It's totally clear what the Glazers' priority is. It's money. It's the brand. It's making the asset more and more valuable. I have no doubt that the Glazers would rather become the first £1 billion revenue club than win the Champions League. Absolutely no doubt about that. I mean, it's an opinion, but it's totally clear after 13 years where the Glazers' priorities lie. They're more interested in competing with Real Madrid and Barcelona off the pitch than on the pitch. That's controversial to say so. What people should be angry about when you've got a club with the size of United, the potential of United, being run in a way that it's, you know, the football is an added extra.
You can also throw in the $500 million that's gone out of the club in servicing the debt and fees to the Glazers.
I think it's a lot more than that.
But I think, more than $500 million.
Yeah.
Well, whatever it is, it's an enormous amount of money. But to me, this is the interesting conundrum. It's fine being commercial and talking about the brand. But eventually, if you have, you know, more and more seasons like the ones we've seen, you know, 5.5 seasons of basically a bunch of turds on the pitch in terms of performance with three different managers, it's going to hurt the brand commercially. Because not within England. Manchester United are a massive club. We know that people who have ties to United, whether it's through family, whether it's through whether it's because they live in Manchester, that's not going to go away. But this is a club that derives an enormous amount of its revenue from around the world. And as they keep reminding us with the 750 million or 650, or however many it is, you know, United quote unquote followers and whatever, they're never going to go to Old Trafford. And yet they still provide revenue to the club by via sponsorships and buying United merchandise and whatnot. new people come to the game as they grow up, and they won't think of United as this all-conquering force as they were between 1991 and 2012 when they finished first or second 19 out of 22 times. They're going to think of United as some sort of perpetual basket case with unlikable managers who play bad football. And at some point, and they may end up supporting other clubs as a result. Maybe not. And they're probably more likely to switch brands, and new ones aren't going to be United fans. And down the road, it's going to hurt United commercially.
Well, let's focus on what Jose Mourinho said after the match, after the comeback at Old Trafford. In his post-match interviews, he spoke about a manhunt. Is there a manhunt with Mourinho?
Thank you for correcting it. His English. He said manhunting. He means manhunt.
I know.
No, I think what he said was absolutely, I mean, I'm assuming the reaction's the same everywhere, right? He kept repeating it's a big boy and stuff. So he knows that this is what happens. It's not a manhunt. He's shouldering most of the blame because he deserves most of the blame because he signed many of these players. He lays out the tactics. He lays out the formations. He gets paid £50 million a year to do it. When he comes out and says people don't play for the manager, they'll play for anybody. Oh, really? Oh, well, then why do they need to get you in there? You could get Gearbrand, who no doubt would do the job for, I'm assuming, 1/10 as much, maybe 1/100 as much, if the manager doesn't matter. So, no.
Don't sell yourself short.
I think this is just fodder. I think people see right through this. When he started going on about the wickedness, yeah, there's wickedness out there. And I think somebody tweeted this. I said, gee, I wonder what Arsene Wenger would think about hearing Mourinho talk about wickedness, or the late Tito Villanova, or any of the dozens of people who've been on the receiving end here. I don't think anything he said was heartfelt. This is all part of an act. It's something he feels he needs to do to strengthen his position, and that's fine. His job is to try and fix Manchester United by any means necessary. But I think equally, I don't think any sane person buys what he says.
It's not like people are saying this guy must go. It's like saying this. It's saying this guy is under pressure, and it's reporting it in a very dramatic way, certainly, and a very sensationalistic way sometimes. But it's not a manhunt. There are people who have been saying, look, it's not his fault. It's the player's fault. Look, it's not his fault. It's the board's fault. I think there's loads of blame to go around for what's wrong with United. And I think some of it is his fault, and I think a lot of it's the board's fault, and I think a lot of it's the player's fault. But I don't think any objective person would say he's the victim of a manhunt. I think he is certainly under pressure, and it can't be pleasant. I think he doesn't handle these situations in a way that deflects pressure at all. It might deflect blame at certain times, but the sort of antagonistic way he goes about things perhaps attracts more pressure.
I think one thing about Mourinho as well is that even when they win, as they did at the weekend, because of, as Ollie said, the antagonistic way in which he's managing, you know, you have to ask yourself, there seems to be so much collateral damage. And I mean, one thing that we haven't talked about is, you know, in the match against Newcastle is Eric Bailly was subbed off after, you know, humiliation subbed, as some people called it on Twitter, after, I can't remember, like 26 minutes?
Not even
like
that, 19.
No, 19 minutes. I mean, and, you know, I was thinking, like, you know, probably 18 or even 12 months ago, you know, I felt Bailly was really one of the best centre-backs in the Premier League. And I was sort of thinking, you know, that Manchester United's future centre-back partnership, it really, I felt, was Bailly and one other. And for whatever reason, his form has declined, whether that's to do with Mourinho's management. You obviously, I suppose you never quite know. But, you know, at the very least, Bailly is still, you know, he's still a useful player. You could say exactly the same for Scott McTominay, who seems to be being used as a bit of a pawn as well.
And he was scared, too.
He was,
because of the manhunting.
Who he came out afterwards and said was scared. Where do those two players go now?
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive and June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive and June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
I'm Manveen Rana from The Story, a daily news podcast from The Times. Join me and my co-host, Luke Jones, for a deep dive into the big stories and investigations. Plus, each month, William Hague hosts an agenda-setting interview with a key newsmaker or big thinker. That's The Story, The Times' daily podcast that brings you one remarkable story told in depth. Listen every weekday on The Times radio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
To Craven Cottage now, where Arsenal thrashed Fulham 5-1 to make it 9 wins in a row in all competitions. They're now just 2 points off top spot in the Premier League, one of 5 teams who could go top after the international break. James, should we be taking them more seriously?
For me, just based on what I've seen from Arsenal, while obviously being impressed by their recent run of results, I slightly remain to be convinced by Arsenal. I think with Arsenal, they have obviously massive goal power. They will always be capable of these sort of results because they have two elite goal scorers. They signed two elite goal scorers in Lacazette and Aubameyang, who, apart from a brief dip in the second half of last season on Lacazette's part, have really, by and large, continued to score at pretty much an elite rate. For me, just having watched Arsenal, I saw them in the game against Everton, which they won. They actually kept a clean sheet in that game, but they gave up a lot of chances, and I really like Lucas Torreira. I thought he was good in that match, and I think he's been good generally, and I wrote in praise of him in that match. But I certainly don't think he's been a panacea to their problems in that area. I think they still do have issues with, you know, the balance of midfield and whether midfield provides enough cover to the defence. And certainly on that occasion, I saw Everton got in behind a lot. And I think that's only one of two clean sheets they've kept, and I think they certainly gave up a lot of chances in that game. And I think by all accounts in the Watford game, which was the other clean sheet, they also gave up chances. So I slightly remain to be convinced. I think their recent run obviously is impressive. I think it's slightly obviously a case of, you know, them having had their two most difficult matches of the season at the start, and they've obviously had a slightly kinder schedule. But look, results have obviously been good.
Well, in the game today, Gab, I can see you're looking at it right now. There's a lovely diagram of Arsenal's third goal, finished off by Aaron Ramsey. It was a sensational team goal. Is it the goal of the season?
I don't know, because in this country, when you guys have goal of the season competitions, you guys always seem to choose like the guy who just belts the ball from 40 yards out rather than, like, you know, a team goal. And Ramsey did take two touches in the build-up. Otherwise, it would have been even better. No, like, this is absolutely sensational. I think sometimes you just take a step back. You just marvel at the aesthetic beauty. If you're a Time subscriber, you can actually go online and you can actually see this and watch it again and again, because it really is a thing of beauty. Does it mean that Arsenal are contenders? I'm with Gearbrand on this one. They've played a bunch of, I think, generally not particularly good teams when they've played some of the better teams in that run. Like you were talking about Everton, and I throw the Watford game in there as well, where, you know, they got results, but I don't think they played necessarily great. You look at this lineup, and again, yeah, it worked in the second half, but again, no Ozil. And Aubameyang was on the bench. Now, what does he have in mind? How is he going to fit these pieces together? Because at some point, you presume those guys are going to play. I don't know. There's still a lot of question marks, but that's fine. This is supposed to be a rebuilding year. We can't expect Emery to have the answers now. The whole point of rebuilding is you find the answers. But no, I don't see them competing for the title this season.
It was interesting. They're looking at Aaron Ramsey's celebration, sort of, in a way, a bit muted and a little bit like, perhaps because the fact that contract offer was withdrawn by the club. A lot of suggestions that he could leave as early as January now because he can't agree on this contract with the club. There is also suggestions he'd like parity with Mesut Ozil. That's partly why this contract negotiation is being halted. Is he that sort of calibre of player, James?
No, I don't think he is the short answer. I mean,
also probably. I mean, come on, this is stupid money. I mean, who earns this in the Premier League?
I mean,
this is what, who makes this money in the Premier League?
This is what you would call, this is what Americans would call franchise player money. This is the money that you play your absolute top star. And for me, Ramsey is not even, he's not even a guaranteed starter. I mean, you look at the Arsenal team, it looks like Torreira and Xhaka is going to be the sort of the favoured double pivot. And then you've got, obviously, you would assume that the first choice 11 would contain Lacazette, Aubameyang and Ozil, which leaves one other place. Does Ramsey have a cast iron grip on that place?
I'm
sure he plays some games. He's not a guaranteed starter. He's not 10 assists a season or 10 goals a season, man. And the other thing is that Arsenal clearly have a lot of money tied up in wages, obviously because of that new deal for Ozil and the signings of Aubameyang and Lacazette. And I think that probably to an extent contributed to what was in some ways perhaps a slightly more underwhelming summer transfer window than you might have expected. So for me to, and you know, Ramsey is not, he's not particularly young. For me, it doesn't make sense for Arsenal to tie up that amount of money in paying him, you know, franchise player money. It's just not, it's nonsensical to me.
Alison Rudd says Fulham need to change the way they play. Stop trying to outscore the opponent. They also have the worst defence in the Premier League as well. James, what do you make of what's going on at Fulham?
Defensively, they're an absolute shambles at the moment. I think, you know, we've played 8 games. They haven't kept a clean sheet in one. And I think they've, in fact, conceded more than one in 7 of those 8 games. I mean, the massive problem for Fulham at the moment is you look at the lineups they've played. I don't think they've played the same back four or back line in any match so far. I think they've changed in every single game. And, you know, contrast that with Wolves, who have played an unchanged back five in every single match, I think. You know, you look at how consistent Brighton's defensive lineup was last season when they came up. You know, how slowly Eddie Howe evolved Bournemouth's team when they came. Obviously, they signed a lot of players in the summer, a lot of defenders as well. One thing I quite liked about their summer business was that, all right, if you decide that Dennis Odoi and Tim Ream aren't good enough, they signed Alfie Mawson and they loaned Callum Chambers, who actually have played together before in the England under-21 team, but for whatever reason, you know, Mawson was injured a bit at the start of the season, but in the last 2 games he hasn't been in the squad. So that pairing has only played together once. The defensive combination has been different in every single game, and I think that is just, that's just an absolute killer when you're new to the division, you're trying to build up a bit of consistency. You know, so I think for Slavisa Jokanovic after the international break, the big priority has to be to really settle on a back four and you know, try and get them some reps together.
Time now to find out how we got on in our weekly predictions game, Gab.
We both had City winning at Anfield, but gee, thank you, Riyad Mahrez. You messed it up for both of us, so no points there.
Yes. You're sounding very glum, Gab. I wonder why. We both predicted Manchester United to beat Newcastle, but neither of us would have foreseen the Magpies scoring. And of course, they were 2-0 up inside 10 minutes.
Now, we both predicted Barcelona would win 2-0 at Valencia. But it's now 4 games without a win in La Liga for the champions. They were held 1-1 at the Mestalla, and they keep conceding goals because, you know what? Gerard Pique and Thomas freaking Vermaelen. sorry, Gerard Pique is going through a horrendous patch right now. In the championship, both of us had faith in managerless Villa to get a result at Millwall. Well, we were both wrong again.
So, Gab, it all came down to Fulham-Arsenal on Sunday lunchtime. Gab had faith in Fulham to claim a point, but that wasn't the case. Now, I, of course, didn't predict a 5-1 win, but I did at least say that Arsenal were going to be victorious, which means... Go on.
So it's 1-1 at halftime, to be fair.
And doesn't mean anything. That's
not the full-time
result.
Arsenal had to score really good goals to go and get that 5-1 win.
Yeah, but they still
really
won.
Fair.
No, I'm taking it. So I win for a second week in a row, Gab. Is that right? Second week in a row?
Mm-hmm.
So you now have a slender lead of 4-3. And don't forget, it was 4-1 a couple of weeks ago. I'm coming for you.
Yes, that's right. You're the Manchester United of this predictions game.
Okay, it's now time for quick hits. Chelsea roll over Southampton 3-0. Alvaro Morata getting on the score sheet as well. James, he's now got 2-2. Is it a sign that he's back to what he thought he could be? And if so, does that mean Chelsea become legitimate contenders?
I think Chelsea are playing really well at the moment. I think Morata offers more. He offers more upside than Giroud, doesn't he? So I think for Sarri, I think it would certainly be good if Morata did show signs of getting back to that form. But then on the other hand, I think Hazard looks really comfortable playing with Giroud, who kind of brings him into play a lot. So I don't know. Interesting dilemma.
I'll answer that for you. No, given the horrendous sitter that he missed earlier. And I think Chelsea still need a little way to go before they become legitimate contenders. Cardiff put Spurs through the ringer, but they eventually prevail through an Eric Dier goal. But that Joe Rawls red card was a big talking point for your close personal friend, Neil Warnock. Gearbrandt, you were there. How did you see it?
I think in a way it's one of those where it was kind of two yellows that added up to a red, if that makes sense. It was a yellow for the kind of extreme cynicism of stopping Lucas Moura in that position. And he obviously, rather than had he been a bit cuter about it and tugged his shirt, he went in and basically cleaned him out. Not with a challenge that would have been a straight red ordinarily, but, maybe given the fact that the ball was miles away, I think it probably it did all that up to a red card.
Yeah, there's no reason whatsoever to do that.
Do you know what I like best about it there? What Neil Warnock said is that he's not endangering the life of a player. I don't know why it's a red card.
Yes, exactly.
High benchmark for what's a red.
Attempted murder.
Yeah. Wolves win again, this time at Crystal Palace. James, how do they do it? Is it down to Nuno Espirito Santo playing the same lineup week in, week out?
I think that does help, to be honest. I think, when Nuno Espirito's team coming up, I think they'll have that consistency of system does help. I think the wing-backs have been outstanding for Wolves. I think Barry Douglas was their leading assister last season. I think there was a slight worry over whether they could replace him, but I think Doherty has really stepped up and Johnny Castrato has been really good as well. And obviously, in central midfield, they have two great passers in Neves and Matinha.
Bournemouth make it three wins on the trot, hammering Watford 4-0 away, and they're up to sixth in the table. Gearbrandt, does this mean Eddie Howe's stock goes right back up and that maybe some guys in the Northwest ought to take notice the next time there's a job opening?
I mean, I'm not really sure Eddie Howe's stock should ever really have fallen in any meaningful way. I mean, I think he's done an incredible job at Bournemouth, obviously, with, some players that were playing for him, in the Championship, I think possibly even in League One. I think he's still got
but
some players.
But new ones, too. This Jefferson Lerma is an absolute monster.
Jefferson Lerma is an absolute monster. I think that is really good, because I think that going on to, whether Howe is ready for a big job, I think the one big knock on Eddie Howe is that his signings generally have not had, the hit rate hasn't been incredible.
Especially when he signs foreign players, which is not very often, and they tend to not be very good for him.
Well, actually, I think probably his best signing was Nathan Ake. I think Nathan Ake has been probably the outstanding. Yeah.
Yes, Nathan Ake is foreign, but he's a Chelsea youth product, so you know what I mean. Signings from abroad.
All right. I think generally he has not been that good in the transfer market.
Gab, I got one for you. I understand Bayern are down to sixth in the Bundesliga. That wasn't supposed to happen, was it?
No, it wasn't. And Kovac, actually, his record is worse than Carlo Ancelotti's was a year ago when he got sacked. But that's okay. We don't want to rub things in. I think the difficulty is that I don't think he will get sacked, because Bayern made such a big show of how it was so important to have a club guy and, a guy who spoke with him in a Bavarian accent and blah, blah, blah. But yeah, it's not a great situation. He's playing this 4-1-4-1 system. Thiago Alcantara sitting in front of the back four. Thiago Alcantara, wonderful passer, but obviously not much of a defensive filter. On top of that, the four attacking midfielders ahead of him, they're all either older or not very good off the ball defensively, or they haven't been, with some exceptions. So yeah, they got absolutely thumped at home by Borussia Mönchengladbach at the weekend. And it really looked like in the second half, the players stopped playing, which is never a great sign. Natalie, how about one for you?
Uh-huh.
I'm a big fan of Paul Hirst, our distinguished Manchester-based journalist for The Times and son of the former Sheffield Wednesday striker, David Hirst. But I hear there's another Hirst out there named Paul Hirst, who's at Ipswich Town with my buddy Marcus Evans, I believe, right?
Yes, but of course this Ipswich Hirst is it's a different spelling. He's got a U, not an I.
So he misspells his last name.
You could say that if that's what you want to say, although he'll think that our very own Paul Hirst from The Times might spell his name wrong. But anyway,
this is Jeff's nephew. Yes, you're talking about.
That's the one, yes. Yes, as you say, he is the manager of Ipswich, a summer appointment following the departure of Mick McCarthy. Hirst had previously been at Shrewsbury, led them to the League One playoff final last May. They lost that one to Rotherham. And that, by the way, was the club he pretty much spent his entire career at, Paul Hirst. I had a brief loan spell at Burton, but yes, very much a Miller. But he's in the news this week because Ipswich, for the first time this season after 12 games, won in the Championship. Unbelievable. With a 3-2 victory at Swansea. They are second bottom in the league right now. But as I say, they picked up their first win. Paul Hurst, he finally got his first win. That is it for now. Many thanks to our guests today, James Gearbrand and Sir Oliver Kay.
Remember, you can subscribe to The Times and The Sunday Times to enjoy award-winning journalism online and on your smartphone or tablet. It'll cost you just £1 a month for a 3-month trial. I think that's quite a deal. And as part of it, you also get to watch that Ramsey goal over and over and over again. Search The Times subscription for more information.
We'll be back on Thursday to discuss the competition that Jurgen Klopp says is the most senseless in the world of football. That's the Nations League.
The Game is brought to you by The Times. For more information and more podcasts from The Times, head to thetimes.co.uk.
Hey folks, I'm Mark Maron from the WTF podcast, and this episode is brought to you by Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues, your ally to help tackle your allergy symptoms this season. I love the change of seasons, but nobody loves pollen and all those other things floating in the air that make you sneeze during this nice weather. Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues are hypoallergenic and allergist approved. So fight back against watery eyes and runny noses without worrying about irritating your skin. For this allergy season, grab Kleenex and face allergies head on.